All right, so now I'm going to hand it off to another Steve from CCB, Mr. Steve Bauer, who's going to introduce our next topic. Steve Bauer, are you around?
I am here, and thank you, Sarah. Good morning, everybody. Got a great group of folks here, almost 50 on Zoom, and have no idea how many are listening on ACB Media, but great to have everybody along with us. As we navigate the future together, CCB relies on our incredible advocacy of our members. That's been proven in the last hour and also last night. And we also rely on the advocacy of our partners, folks who work with us. And our next speaker is certainly one of those. Stuart Seaborn has been involved with a number of issues with CCB. Stuart's Managing Director of Litigation at Disability Rights Advocates. He joined DRA in 2011 and has been advocating in the public interest for over 20 years. He specializes in systemic litigation on behalf of persons with disabilities and has achieved multiple national precedents on matters of first impression in the area of disability rights. In one example, Disabled in Action versus Board of Elections, Mr. Seaborn secured the first federal appellate decision to hold that under the Americans with Disabilities Act, election officials must provide voters with disabilities the same private and independent voting experience they provide to non-disabled voters. He was also lead counsel in Legal Services versus Prisoners with Children. Legal Services for Prisoners with Children versus Ahern, which resulted in a court enforceable settlement agreement to provide disability-based accommodations to persons housed in one of the largest county jail systems in California, and Ochoa versus City of Long Beach, a class action resulting in the installation and improvement of thousands of curb ramps for persons who use wheelchairs. Mr. Seaborn is also an adjunct professor at UC Hastings School of Law. In addition to his work with DRA, he has a solo civil rights practice and worked as a litigator at Disability Rights California. He received his law degree from UCLA School of Law in 1998 and his BA from UC Berkeley in 1995. So amazing that we have folks like this on our team here at CCB. Stuart, thanks for all you do. And he's going to talk to us today about kiosks, which we see in medical facilities and also in fast food restaurants and lots of other places. Stuart, thanks for joining us and looking forward to hearing what you have to tell us.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Steve. I've forgotten about a lot of that stuff over the last 20 years, so it's good to hear it. As you mentioned, I'm here to discuss kiosk accessibility. And I can't tell who's on the call. Do folks have a sense of what I'm talking about when I mention the word kiosk? I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing, because kiosks, when I first started doing this work, I thought about that, you know, when I would get my coffee outside BART, there was an actual person in a kiosk where I would get my coffee and sometimes a paper. And that definition or that term in terms of the ADA and disability work is much broader. So I just want to get a sense. Can folks tell me I don't know how we do this on Zoom, but just, you know, to get a sense of what people think of when I mentioned the word kiosk.
So we do have two raised hands.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble seeing them. So tell me when you're ready.
Okay, so did you want to actually talk to people, or are you just wanting a show of hands? I'm a little bit lost here.
I was going to ask if people can share ideas about what they think of when we talk about the concept of kiosk, so the word kiosk.
Okay, well then, Stephanie Watts, you may speak.
Good morning. When I think of kiosk, I think of, I would call it a station in terms of orientation, a station, something you walk up to in an airport to interact with so you can print a boarding pass, or in a restaurant, you walk up to it to place your order. And anyway, that's my limited thinking on what a kiosk is. Thank you.
Charlene Ornelas, you're next.
I think of a kiosk as being many shapes and many places, but it's somewhere where you walk up instead of interacting with a person, you interact with technology.
That's remarkably helpful. I'll take one more, and then we'll. You're actually hitting what I wanted to discuss, but I'll take
Jessica,
one more.
You are last then.
Hi, good morning. So what I think of a kiosk is an open type of little cart that is outside maybe the mall or inside the mall, or that's just kind of like open. You can also see them at Disneyland when you buy a churro, those little carts, that would be a kiosk. But now we're starting to see kiosks inside Panera with the computerized how to get your coffee instead. So that's what I'm thinking about kiosks now, these little tiny corners of restaurants or fast food places where you can just use an iPad, get the information, get the things you need, and then just get out without even having any human interaction.
So that is the, you guys hit on the kind of the three things I wanted to mention. So our work with kiosk accessibility has really involved the self-service economy. So moving kind of away from the person that used to sell me my coffee outside the BART station in essentially like a kiosk shelter situation, to things where people have the freedom to not have to interact with somebody, to do things essentially at the time in the way they want it. One of the classic examples, we litigated a case involving movie rental kiosks. We're going to talk about it in a second. But I may want like romantic comedies, and I don't want the person at the video store to know that I like romantic comedies. And I had the freedom to go, independently, browse and select something at my leisure. And it really is a sense that that we had starting in about 2011, that the self-service economy was providing a whole range of opportunities for people with and without disabilities. But our particular concern was that the blind community was being left behind because a lot of the self-service technology didn't have things like tactile input or audio output. And that's really how we got involved in this. And I wanted to share, going back to the video rental kiosk. So I started in this work at just answering the phones, doing what's now essentially paralegal work at DRA in 1995. Ended up going to law school. They kind of recommended I go to law school and doing a whole bunch of other work, including antitrust work and labor law and stuff that doesn't relate to this for a while. But I came back to disability work at Disability Rights California in 2002 and bounced around the state with them and ended up working with a blind attorney in Sacramento who's now no longer living in California named Will Schell. And we got a bunch of complaints. And this was right about the time that the movie rental kiosks we were seeing them in supermarkets, we were seeing them in places like malls, outside 7-Elevens, et cetera. And we started getting complaints from a lot of people about the accessibility and wheelchair users, but also from blind people. And I remember going to the first meeting and there were two things that kind of came up in the discussion that I didn't think we'd have to be talking about. One is there was a question as to, what are these things and are they even covered by the law? And that was, that was a hurdle we had to address. And thankfully over the last, 15, 20 years, there's plenty of ways we can address that. And the second thing that surprised me with the video rental kiosks is that the, even some of the expert witnesses and the, the manufacturers and the retailers had questions about, do blind people actually watch movies? And that, having to kind of address both of those, that's an educational hurdle and the legal hurdle, we realized that we really wanted to start dedicating time to this kind of work. And it was fortuitous for me because I started working with folks at DRA on the kiosk issue with people like Larry Paradis and Mike Nunez, and I ended up moving to DRA to work at DRA full time. So that the kiosk work actually was a nice bridge for me. And it kind of helped us address some of these self-service issues. And really, as at DRA, we've had a focus on new technologies and making sure that new technologies do not leave the disability community and in particular the blind community behind. And even before that, I think it's important to talk about some history before we get to where things stand today with kiosk accessibility. And again, I'm referring, when I say kiosk, I'm referring to the kind of self-service technology broadly. And it includes some of the things that you mentioned just now, things like restaurant ordering devices, transit kiosks, et cetera, not limited to what, you know, people physically we think of as a kiosk. And we actually, in our work, in our thinking to help us particularly assess what coverage exists under the law, we start with the talking ATMs that a lot of folks here, you know, a lot of people at CCB actually worked on, you know, 20 years ago or 20 plus years ago, and the advocacy behind those, and that essentially paved the way for kiosk accessibility. Members of CCB, as well as folks like Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian, working with advocates, but also through structured negotiations, working with large corporate banking entities such as Bank of America and Wells Fargo, to really kind of without having to get court orders to get these large corporate entities to buy into the technology and the development of technology, so that there would be at minimum tactile input and audio output for ATM machines. And the momentum was in full swing. That's that we're talking about 20 years ago. Moving into 2010 with the Access Board, and the idea was that the level of access should advance as technology advances. And fortunately, it was a big technology boom during that time period. And the Access Board and later the Department of Justice issued regulations and implemented them at the federal level, requiring for ATM machines and fare machines, again, the minimum of tactile input and audio output. And that was a real boon to us at the time, because we could see that ATMs were essentially one of the first in the banking industry. That was one of the first self-service technologies. And we could really see the idea that there might be a way to expand this concept to kind of the boom in self-service technology that was happening in other industries. And at the time, the regulations were issued, and for those of you who want to look this up, certainly you can talk to me. This is at section 707 of the ADA's architectural guidelines, or the ADAG standards for ATMs and fare machines. Fare machines are like transit fare machines, things that you would find at, say, BART, Muni, or Sacramento Regional Transit. And that was a kind of momentous time for us, because we were, at the same time we were getting those regulations, we were seeing the growth of the self-service industry all over. And unfortunately, we were seeing that the particularly touchscreen technologies were being implemented without the input of the blind community. And so our hope was to use some of the growth in the law and regulation that had come out of this kind of ATM structured negotiation advocacy to push for more requirements for other kinds of self-service technology and kiosks. And there was a lot of momentum then, and there has been a lot of progress, but I will say it was the growth wasn't as linear as we expected. So it's kind of, today we're left with kind of a patchwork and piecemeal set of regulations and coverage of kiosks. But I do think there is reason to be optimistic, because with this patchwork network, you're probably going to find some sort of hook if you have a kiosk or a piece of self-service technology that is inaccessible to people who are blind or have low vision. I wish that accessibility was being built in more at the front end, because it's always more difficult to go after the fact and fix it. But there are a lot of legal hooks available, even with this kind of patchwork set of regulations, and I want to go over some of them today. The first thing I want to talk about is kiosks operated by government entities. That's one of the classic examples is we think of as one of our cases on the East Coast. There was a set of kiosks under the guise of an organization called Link New York City, or Link NYC. And these were informational kiosks. So for in tourist areas, for example, providing information about tourist sites, about public transportation, some advertisements, things like where to get a place to stay, And also things that were helpful to not just the tourists, but to everyday New Yorkers, like, you know, having a jack to charge your phone, et cetera. And one of the benefits of these kind of kiosks being both operated and under the responsibility of public entities, and the Link NYC, although it was a private vendor that had created and was tasked with operation of the kiosks, it was under the guise of the municipal government of New York City, that there was no real question about coverage. So public entities, kiosks are essentially, they're a program, service, or activity of the government entity, so state, county, city, et cetera, or public transit entities, and they are covered by Title II of the ADA. There's no question that those entities are covered. So think, you know, not only the Link NYC kiosks, where we filed a case in court, working at that point, I was working with some of the National Federation of the Blind affiliates and their council, and ended up getting a settlement because there was just no question about coverage. And the settlement included things like screen navigation with screen readers and tactile input, et cetera. But there simply just was no question that a kiosk operated by a public entity is covered, and that applies, as I said, to transit kiosks such as BART, MTA, and regional transit. So that's a good hook for anything that is operated by a government entity, whether it's a state, whether it's a county, a municipality, or a public transit entity. I decided to bring up the Link NYC kiosks because we are seeing rumblings throughout California that public entities, particularly urban centers, are starting to use this idea of public information centers with touchscreens. We saw one published, I don't know if it's going to be when it's going to be rolled out, in the city of Oakland. And we are seeing them in other urban centers where, usually with some private monies, but also with public monies, cities are having these kind of public information touchscreens, and unfortunately, some of them are inaccessible. So we're kind of keeping watch on that. But there is no question that those are covered, and that there is at least, while there aren't technical standards as of yet, there is at least a requirement for meaningful access. Essentially, the level of access should be as close as possible to that of the sighted user, which it means independent operation and ability to browse, and which for us in most cases means the tactile input and audio output for controls. I did want to mention the federal government requirements. I think a lot of you are probably familiar with Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act. That applies to government kiosks operated by the federal government, or kiosks where there is federal money involved. And that has benefited us tremendously, partially because there are so many cities and counties when it comes to things like public infrastructure, transportation, et cetera, that receive federal funding. So you can automatically apply the hook of Section 508. And they have what they call accessible technology requirements, and they're not, and this is going to be a theme throughout this discussion today, there aren't many specific technical requirements. So it's not going to tell you like what kind of screen reader or what, you know, whether it has to be, you know, definitely a keypad or some other form of tactile input, or even there may be some variations in keypads. So there's a little bit of a little bit of murkiness in terms of what technical standards will apply. But generally, to be considered accessible under 508, which again, it applies to federal entities or any entities receiving federal funds, and that's a lot, particularly in the area of transit and city and county government when it comes to their infrastructure. And those kiosks must at minimum have some sort of audio output, often audio jacks, tactically discernible input and controls, and some sort of speech output. Oftentimes they're integrated with screen reader software. And I would say if you encounter what appears to be a publicly funded kiosk, I would, you know, and it's not accessible, that's a real problem. And certainly you could let us know, because these requirements have been in existence for some time, and they should at least be independently operational by folks who are blind or have low vision. And 508 is also wonderful in many ways, because the state of California has adopted the requirements of Section 508 under the California government code for state entities and entities receiving state funding. So even if there's no federal funding involved, there are plenty of state-funded entities that should have accessible or required to have accessible technology. One of the areas we've looked at is healthcare, and I'll talk about that in a second. But anytime there's any, whether it's state Department of Healthcare Services money at the state level, whether it's Medicaid or Medi-Cal funding or Medicare funding at the federal level, it's going to be covered, at least it has to meet the requirements of 508, whether it's because there are federal monies involved or state monies. So I would just in terms of a rule of thumb, if it's government of any kind, or even if it's something that's operated by a private vendor, but there's government money, whether it's state or federal involved, there's going to be some sort of independently operational requirement that's likely going to require both tactile input and audio output. And I would say if you're hearing about things in development or you're seeing any self-service technology along those lines, whether it's a municipal government putting it out there, whether it's healthcare, whether it's a transit operator, let us know, because there is going to be at least some sort of requirement we can hang our hat on due to whether it's Title II of the ADA, whether it's Section 508, or the adoption of Section 508 by the state of California for entities that are funded with state monies. So that brings us to the question of private businesses. I'm gonna pause for a second and see if anybody has any question about the government kiosks before we move on to the private businesses.
Pedro, you have been given permission to talk. So if you can unmute.
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes, now you can.
Hello. Okay, sorry about that. I couldn't find the mute button. My question is, what about kiosks at airports? I haven't flown since prior to COVID, but I will be doing so soon. And I'm wondering, are they required to be accessible at the airports?
So it's a good transition to discussing moving on from government kiosks to some of the private or kind of private public crossover kiosks. And one of the categories that we're going to discuss, and I'll just discuss it now, is airline or airport kiosks. And I just wanted to distinguish between the two. If there's a kiosk in the airport that is not an airline's kiosk, if it's something with general information. So I can think of, we had a case involving the Sacramento airport, and the areas within the airport that were not controlled by the airlines. So when you enter the airport in the kind of waiting areas, et cetera, even in the ticketing areas, those where you can argue it's controlled by the airport, then that would be something that is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. So for example, there are nowadays one of the companies is called Clear. There are several other companies that operate some of the screening. We've heard rumblings of kiosk-based screening on the horizon. And my argument, if there's an accessibility problem, would be those are probably part of the airport structure. They're within the airport, and they're probably going to be covered by the ADA. Bringing in the government entity who runs the airport and having that be considered a service of the airport, and thus a service of the government entity. So that's one area. And if it's a service of the airport as the government entity, so I think the Sacramento County runs the Sacramento Airport, the Port Authority and the Bay Area runs the Oakland Airport, et cetera, we would be able to look to them to advocate for having those kiosks accessible. I want to separate that from airline kiosks, and there's been a mess probably for at least 12 or 13 years. There's been litigation and debate about whether the ADA even applies to airline kiosks. And the short answer is no, it doesn't. The airlines themselves are governed by the Air Carrier Access Act, which is a separate statute from the ADA. It's enforced by the Department of Transportation and the Federal Transportation Administration, which has its own set of regulations. And one positive is that the regulations technically do require similar accessibility to Section 508. So there has to be some form of independent way to operate the kiosk for folks who are blind or have low vision. The problem is, well, two problems. One is there's no private right of action. So say you called me and, you know, you went, I'm just going to pick on Alaska Airlines because I've talked about them recently and they're fresh in the mind. But say you called me and said, I went to Oakland Airport and I tried to use the kiosk that was, you know, in front of Alaska Airlines to get to, you know, to whether to check my bag or whatever it is. And it was inaccessible, or maybe it was an accessible machine, but it wasn't maintained, it wasn't working. I could not represent you on a claim in court against Alaska Airlines. I would have to refer you to an administrative complaint with the Department of Transportation and the FTA. And they do have, so they have the power that, you know, the government regulators have the power to issue enforcement orders. But what we've seen is two things. One is the regulations gave the public entities, gave the airlines 10 years to comply with the accessibility requirements for kiosks. And then even within that 10 years, I think is actually coming up soon, or maybe already passed. I think we're on the cusp of the 10 years. But the problem is that there are negotiations and settlement agreements with airlines who said they couldn't do it. And so there are some agreements, I think one of them is ANA Airlines, where even now they've gotten an extension. So I'll throw out the positive. The positive is that there are regulations and they kind of mirror the Section 508 requirements, that there's got to be the kind of independent operation so that the blind or low vision user has access to independent operation for those same functions that the sighted user does. But it's going to be slow in terms of enforcement. And the other thing is, like, you know, advocacy groups like ourselves, who we consider partners of CCB in our ability to take these things on, are going to be less able to do anything because the biggest tool we have is litigation, and that has been removed from us, unfortunately. So that's airports. But if it's a general informational kiosk or you know, I would probably argue some of the screening where the screening is not specific to a particular airline, there would be an argument that would be covered by these federal government or local government requirements. Does that answer the question?
Pedro, I have given you permission again to talk. I do apologize. I wasn't sure if I should have or not, but if you'd like to unmute to see if your question was answered.
Okay, I just want to know. My question was answered. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to move away from government entity kiosk, and the last thing I'll say about those is that we feel pretty good about coverage of government kiosks with including airports, with the exception of what's run by the airlines. And I would say if you get an airline issue, I'd be happy to talk about it. Particularly, there are some techniques we've learned from folks who've done the administrative complaints in terms of what gets the regulator's attention. So we'd be happy to talk about that. But it is a difficulty for us because we don't have the power ourselves to do the representation in court. And that's been a bit of a frustration. I do want to talk about private businesses that have kiosks, because that's an area where there's been a mixed bag of results of litigation. And I want to give you the best information we have to date, so that if you encounter a private business's kiosk, you at least know where things stand in terms of coverage and requirements. So the short way to start with private businesses is that in terms of the federal law with the ADA, private businesses that open themselves up to the public are covered by Title III of the ADA. Unfortunately, Title III was written at a time, I'm sure you've heard much discussion about the internet and mobile apps, and there isn't specific kind of written coverage of those in Title III, and there's been a big discussion. There's been the Domino's Pizza case that I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, about what does that mean if it's not explicitly in writing, but you know, it could have been contemplated by the statute, et cetera. Well, there's a similar discussion with kiosks, because apart from things like ATMs and fare machines, there wasn't really much even in the 2010 regulations that discussed coverage of kiosks. And so people have really had to enforce their rights in the courts. And there isn't a great amount of there's certainly not as much of consistency as we would want. one of the vehicles for coverage of private business kiosks really relates to, you know, where is this thing? So if you go to the example of the, you know, the movie rental kiosks like Redbox, and I'm sure, like, you know, there still are Redbox kiosks. I think the settlement agreement has expired, but this was very live for us back in 2011. But kiosks that are in places of business that open their doors to the public. So in addition to those things like the Coinstar kiosks, those, you know, they may be operated by a separate company, but if they're housed within another business that opens its doors to the public, so would it essentially be considered under law a place of public accommodation, you could argue, and I think successfully, that the kiosk that's in there is a service that is offered by that place of public accommodation, even if it's another business. So that's one way to get coverage. And there have been plenty of cases where even if the kiosk is operated by somebody entirely different, it's not, you know, that doesn't even have the same, you know, the title is not the company that runs the building. And we've even seen it where, like, there's a mall and there's a kiosk in the mall. You could argue that the mall is a place of public accommodation and the kiosk is a service the mall offers, even again, if they're completely separate companies. So that is one vehicle towards coverage. And for those, there aren't explicit standards in terms of technical standards, but you could argue certainly that the operation needs to provide the same level or as close to the level of independence as possible, similar to what the sighted user has. And there have been several settlement agreements across the country where we've seen this. And so I feel pretty comfortable if you've got a business, you know, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a grocery store, whether it's a pharmacy, whether it's a movie theater, and it's got a kiosk that is either in front of it or inside the physical structure, you can probably argue with confidence that it's covered. And for folks out in the community, if you see some one of these that you know folks are using independently, it's a great self-service option, and it's not available to the blind community, I'd love to know about it. The one thing I did want to point out in those situations is there's a bad case out there in Texas in the Fifth Circuit about soda machines, and we've never done any litigation around soda machines, and we have to kind of rely on what's out there being done by others. And there's a court in the Fifth Circuit that has said, well, even if it's within a business, a soda machine really isn't a place of public accommodation. It's just like a vending machine. And there are some requirements for vending machines to be accessible, but you can't really bring them in as a place of public accommodation under the ADA. And there are a couple bad cases about soda machines out there. There's one involving Moe's, which I think is a restaurant chain on the East Coast. There's also one involving Five Guys. And that brings me to the other exception I wanted to point out to you about private business kiosks. And that is what we refer to, and we have even, you know, for the last 15 years, we've referred to this as the dreaded customer service exception. And this is a situation where the place of business, the private business, can argue that although there is a kiosk or there's, you know, there's some sort of self-service technology in its business, in its place of public accommodation, that allows the sighted user to operate the technology independently. And that we've seen this in plenty of locations, but the examples that have come up in the courts have involved either soda kind of soda selection and ordering machines, or there was one involving the McDonald's touchscreen ordering system. But in both of those scenarios, and particularly with the soda machines, the courts have said, well, you know, this is probably a service of a public accommodation, so it's probably covered by the law, but we don't think there's a denial of access that rises to the level that violates the statute, because there is a customer service option, and there's always going to be a customer service option there. Now, that's something I think, you know, if we saw one of those cases, we would look at it really on a case-by-case basis to see, well, it really is there, you know, where is the customer service located? how similar is the access that the blind user has as opposed to the sighted user. But I just wanted to give you that warning, because that is it's a theme that has propped up in the last, 6 or 7 years, that is a potential limitation on access to self-service technologies. I will say that we're actually being helped a little bit in our arguments by the industry, because they are moving, and industries all over are moving away from staffing. It's very expensive in terms of labor costs to have folks staffing all of these things. And the fewer staff they have, the harder it is for them to make that argument that the self-service technology in the form of the kiosk or the tablet or whatever is indeed accessible or available in a similar way as it is to the sighted public. So I would expect some sort of turnaround on those, but I wanted to make you all aware that I probably wouldn't take a case involving a kind of soda vending or a fast food restaurant ordering system where there is somebody kind of hovering over the customer. Either way, I'm about to say something that possibly contradicts that. I'm hoping it'll be clear, but let me know. We have had cases though involving tablet ordering systems that are within places of public accommodations like restaurants. One of my favorites, this place doesn't exist anymore, but I'm hoping it comes back after the pandemic. There was a restaurant in San Francisco, Berkeley, Washington, DC, and New York called Itza. And it was it served quinoa, which is a kind of a high protein food gained a lot of popularity during the last few years. And Itza did not have staff serving people. You'd order from the touchscreen. There was probably only one person working in the restaurant, and there would be these cubby holes that had touchscreens on them where you pick up the food. And after a complaint was filed in both California and New York, Itza, through its counsel, quickly recognized that it was going to have a hard argument on customer service, because there really wasn't much customer service going on in the restaurant. And it agreed to make its tablet ordering or its touchscreen ordering system accessible. Unfortunately, Itza has moved on. But that was a good sign for us. And then following Itza, we worked on cases involving tablet touchscreens at Applebee's. And there were good facts on the ground. Actually, some folks on this call were involved in some of the structured negotiations around Applebee's. But one of the good facts is you could pretty much, as a customer, you could take care of most of the tasks you needed to order and to pay and to browse and so on the tablet. And so there wasn't going to be as much of a customer service defense. And Applebee's agreed to make its tablet ordering systems accessible. We didn't bring it, but there's been a case involving Panera, and I'd love to see how the settlement is playing out, because in theory, Panera should be shifting to making its tablet ordering systems accessible. But I think those are really, particularly in retail settings where the cost of labor has increased, there's a lot of inflation, et cetera, that we are going to be seeing far more of these touchscreen devices. And there are the fewer staff you have, or the more independence there is for the sighted user, which doesn't involve customer service, I think the better arguments folks are going to have that the customer service exception doesn't apply and that touchscreen should be accessible. The other point I wanted to make about that is that there are this kind of a burgeoning group of engineers and consultants who are working or able to work at the ground level. So before the device is in the restaurant, they're able to work with the operating systems, whether they're iOS operating systems or Android or others, that can make this stuff accessible from the design stage as opposed to after the fact. So that is helping in terms of the argument that it's certainly not going to be an undue burden for these businesses to make these kiosks or tablets. And again, we refer to kiosks as kind of the self-service technology in general to make those accessible. I also wanted to point out a bad case that also involves this dreaded customer service exception. And that is, I don't know if folks are familiar with it, there's a case involving the NFB in Maryland where there were self-service checkout machines. I mean, they're all over the country, but these were at Walmarts in Maryland. And this was the machines themselves were not entirely inaccessible. There were keypads that allowed pin entry, but there was a lot of touchscreen stuff on it too, and that wasn't accessible. And the court basically said, well, you know, people can independently enter the pin on the keypad. The plaintiffs were saying, but look, you know, there's this guy, like, you know, if I have to use a customer service, the guy at the store is watching me do it because they're helping me with the machine. And the court said, well, it's maybe a close call, but it's probably okay to have that level of customer service. And the court dismissed the case, essentially saying that there was a sufficient level of service or a level of access to the technology. That's a bummer for us. We disagree with that opinion, but it's just something for us to keep in mind. I will say, though, that even stores like Walmart are moving to more independent operation, and I do expect the fewer staff in the store, the better the arguments are going to be. So I have some hope for how those will play out in the future, but I did want to let you know that case exists. And it will be something if we bring a case around self-service checkout, we'd certainly have to have arguments to counter those. Any questions? I'm going to start to move to healthcare in
a
second.
We do have a couple of raised hands. And Frank, you are able to talk.
Hi, Stuart. Frank Welty here.
Frank.
Quick question for you. Could you just share a few tips for individuals as to how we can get the advocacy process going when we encounter one of these kiosks in our daily lives? Like, who should we try to find to talk to? Where can we get information? How do we get this going? Because obviously, when you encounter a kiosk, the people working at the place usually have no control over over that kiosk, and they're not really the people that can help to solve the problem.
So you're in a great place, Frank, in terms of being part of CCB, because I think advocacy organizations are by far the best bet. You know, individual stores, individual managers, they just don't have the power, as you said, that, you know, whether goodwill or not, they're just not going to be able to get it done. We have found that, I mean, this issue really is it's a live issue for companies. And I think, you know, thankfully, due to some of the work of you folks and those who've done the structured negotiations, that they're, you know, it's on the radar of general counsel and even this is something that's fairly recent, even some of the design staff, maybe not the directors of design, and there's a disconnect between the general counsel and those kind of directing design, but folks who are involved on the kind of the programming and the engineering side actually are more familiar with this than they were, you know, 5 to 7 years ago. So there is good momentum, and I would say it's probably worth, you know, whether through us or somebody else, the organization, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's California Council of the Blind, whether it's the ACB, whether it's the Lighthouse, whether it's the NFB, whether it's, you know, having some discussion with the general counsel who can bring in whoever is in charge of design. And that is, in our experience, that's been the best bet. I know, Frank, you've been part of some very slow moving structure negotiations, so I don't want to sugarcoat how it's going to work, because some of them are really frustrating. And sometimes it's very hard to get the, you know, the folks on the ground, who in many cases can make this work pretty well, to get them connected with those who are making the decisions. So I don't want to sugarcoat it. But that is, I mean, our experience really is you have to have the strength of an organization like CCB or like the Lighthouse or wherever it is behind it. And then the general counsel will usually, you know, given that this is now on their radar, will usually bring people into the mix. One of the frustrations I have is that we are still seeing, you know, the after the fact, you know, inaccessibility, and it is much harder to change things after the fact. It's getting easier given that there's more consistency with how operating systems work, but it's still harder after the fact. And so, I mean, I guess I would say I'd love to know as early as possible. But if folks are in the community and they're encountering these inaccessible kiosks, I would say we'd be happy to address it. And if it looks like something, you know, something that's covered, we'd be happy to work with CCB or another organization in reaching out to see if we can, you know, we can do something without litigation.
All right, it's 45 minutes past the hour, and we have four raised hands. Jordan, you are next.
Okay. My first question is, what Applebee's did your case involve? And my second question is...
I missed it. What was the first part of the question?
what Applebee's did your case involve? And my second one is that I went to an Applebee's on April 6th, 2022, and there was at my table a tablet or a kiosk that had no audio jack, no earphone jack. And so should I assume that it does not have audible capability? Because if it did, it should have those two things
built in. That's a great question. And it's Applebee's across the country. There should be, and I don't have the dates of the rollout in front of me, but I'm going to guess that the rollout should have happened wherever you are. And I would say, send me an email offline and we will look into it. Cause we can at least contact the general counsel to get an answer of what's going on with that particular location.
Andy Barocco, you were next.
Okay, my issue is Quest Diagnostics. I took my wife there recently for lab work. And the thing is, when you go into Quest Diagnostics, there is no customer service there. That what there is there's a kiosk on the wall. And fortunately, we got a fellow patient who was there to help us sign in on the kiosk. You have to enter your insurance information and the kind of lab work you want and things like that. And then we sat there and we noticed people were going in and out, but nobody was calling anybody. And finally, when somebody was coming out, I kind of went behind him and went inside. And I told someone, I said, my wife and I have been here for quite a while and nobody has called us. And they said, well, no, there's a monitor. You have to watch the monitor. And when you see your name come up, then you go in the door, And so fortunately, we were eventually able to get her in, but I mean, it's a totally inaccessible situation there.
So that's a great transition to healthcare. And I'm going to, if folks don't mind, I'll go into this briefly before taking the next question, because this relates to the healthcare issue. So there is movement both through litigation and settlement, as well as through the Department of Justice and its activity in its own efforts to reach settlement around healthcare kiosks. And there are several, there are kind of a couple categories I want to talk about. One is the check-in kiosk that you mentioned, and the other is healthcare kiosks that actually do services like for blood pressure screenings, et cetera. And both fronts are looking pretty good. The ones that do screenings, you often find them in like a CVS or a Walgreens. There are multiple settlements. I think there are going to be multiple settlements on the horizon as well. So those, in the next few years should be made accessible. With the check-in kiosk, there's a lot of active litigation right now. And it's funny you mentioned Quest Diagnostics, because there's a case involving that exact issue with Quest Diagnostics right now that's being litigated. And one of the real positives, I would say, that, we'll see how it plays out. But one of the positives I will say is that the Justice Department actually it came out with a statement of interest addressing Quest Diagnostics specifically in that case. And it said that these are definitely public places of public accommodation. They're covered by the statute. And as a result, they must provide auxiliary aids and services so that people with disabilities can, quote, enjoy all of those services. And that includes things like making screen reader software or something to provide the audio output as well as the tactile input. So I think that, I wish it was now, but I think that points to a positive change in the near future for healthcare kiosks, including Quest Diagnostics. But I don't think it's going to be immediate. As I said, that this is all ongoing. And with the one kind of difficulty with these rollouts, even when there is a settlement, is they take a long time. So I'm not expecting miracles overnight, but I do think in the next 3 to 4 years, places like Quest, whether through this settlement or hopefully through Department of Justice regulations, are going to be required to have their touchscreens accessible. And I laughed because, when we've called a couple of times around kiosks that involve, something where there's no customer service person, the first thing that they'll tell us is, well, yeah, it's pretty easy. You just look at the touchscreen. We're like, that's the whole problem here. But that's, I still, even in general counsel's office, you still hear that stuff. So I wish, you know, I wish it wasn't that way, but that's, there's still an educational piece to be done as well. So I'm sorry, I just wanted to address that. I know there's another question, but healthcare is looking positive. I don't think it's immediate, but I'm very, very pleased to see the Justice Department has intervened, particularly with Quest. And I'm hoping, you know, we certainly will update all of you if there is a change for the positive there.
Charlene, you may talk.
Thank you. Back to the machines in the fast food restaurants. The vendor of the machine is, or the maker of the machine and producer of it or whatever, is Coca-Cola. And I don't know if that will make a difference in trying to get the accessibility built into it. The other issue is that I don't have the same selection of beverages as does a person who will walk up and use that machine if I need to use the staff behind the counter. Thank you.
Yeah, that is a real live issue. Unfortunately, Coca-Cola was the defendant in the kind of the soda touchscreen machine case in Texas, and they, I'm sure their counsel is going to use that in terms of future litigation and the ability of advocates to really press them on their touchscreen machines. The only thing I'll say is that I think that, you know, that's how the case law exists now. I do think as the technology becomes more and more not only readily available, people are aware of it, that there may be a shift in the future. But I, unfortunately, I'd say if I got a case involving one of those soda vending machines, even, and there are clearly fewer options and fewer independent options. There's no question that it's not equal access. But I don't think I would take it because of this lingering case law, but that may change in the future.
Okay, this next one on the panelist side, but I think he's the guy that introduced you, Steve Bauer.
Hi, yeah, just quickly, Stuart, you were mentioning about federal funds being involved with these litigations. Is the fact that places like Quest are receiving, you know, directly or indirectly Medicare, Medi-Cal funds, does that have any bearing on forcing them to make this stuff more accessible?
Absolutely. And I you know, I'm not involved in the decision, the Justice Department, you know, in their discussions about what we're going to get involved in and what we don't. But I wouldn't be surprised if the fact that, you know, it's healthcare that in many places people are using Medicare, Medicaid, Medi-Cal, et cetera, that has got to be a huge part of it. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the call, there are these requirements when there are federal monies, or in California, they've adopted it for state monies as well. So I would say absolutely. And what our hope is, and I, you know, we'll see how this plays out, but some of the vendors are so big, and particularly when it comes to healthcare, that they may serve multiple chains or multiple HMOs, et cetera, that if they're working on a government funded issue, that they'll, you know, and they're going to have to do the accessible technology anyway, why don't they just make it available across the board? So that is something that, you know, we're hoping happens. And I think, you know, I wasn't part of the Justice Department's decision in terms of why they decided to get involved. But if I was in their shoes, I would be thinking along those lines and target areas where you've got real clean coverage and you've got clean access to liability because there is either federal money or state money, and then see if you can use that. You know, once the technology is in place and the vendors, you know, the vendors can't tell you they don't have it because they do, then to use it to expand it into the private sector.
Great, thank you.
All right, we currently have no raised hands.
So I just wanted to make one, I know we're coming up on the hour, I wanted to make one point, and this is something CCB was heavily involved in. It falls into the theme of self-service technology, but it involves voting. And, you know, you folks at CCB were actively involved in the work, and, you know, Steve, you mentioned in the bio thing, you mentioned the case in New York, but one of the cases that was critical in making sure that the, you know, the secret ballot, our privacy and independence at the poll site was and is made available when you make it available to the sighted public, is a case CCB did in Alameda County, which we are grateful for. And I guess I would say two things. One is there are these voting machines, you know, and we have an election coming up in June, and there's going to, you know, there are elections in November and so on. I think it's worth making sure that they're still accessible at the poll site. People now with COVID restrictions easing are going back to poll sites. So I think it's worth, you know, those cases are, you know, now the settlement agreements are expired. But my experience is that if there's nobody minding the store, the covered entities like the registrars or board of elections will not comply, or they'll lack, you know, they'll be lax on maintenance. So that's something to pay attention to. We'd love to hear results of people who are using the accessible machines to see if they're working or not. The other thing is that we refer to it as self-service technology. It's not exactly kiosks, but we've been working for the last couple of years, particularly during COVID, on absentee voting and some sort of accessible solution via technology. We talked to some folks on this call about that as well. And we've kind of been going state by state, looking at alternates to paper ballots. And I'm hoping that whether it's through some sort of policy-based solution in California or eventually through litigation, that California will catch up with some of these other states and there will be a fillable and accessible solution that doesn't require a paper ballot for absentee. So that's something we're working on. Again, it doesn't necessarily fall under the kind of self-service technology in the sense of machines or kiosks or tablets like we've been talking about, but that is something that's been on our radar for some time. We've got cases, you know, we've been able to get court orders in a couple of states like New York or North Carolina. We recently got a preliminary injunction in Indiana. Our hope is that California will not need something like that, and there'll be some sort of policy solution. We're working with some folks at CCB and Disability Rights California on those policies, but that's something we're paying attention to. And the idea would be people could vote at the machine if they wanted to, and we've got to make sure the machines are maintained at the poll site, but also that they'd have the option of voting absentee in a private, independent way through accessible technology. So I've got 2 minutes. I'll take a couple of questions, but I just wanted to thank all of you for the work CCB does. Many of the cases I talked about are the result of CCB's advocacy and folks on this call, and we certainly wouldn't be where we are without that. And we will continue to pay attention to these touchscreen self-service kiosk and tablet issues. And if you have one that you'd like to raise with us, we'd be happy to investigate.
All right, Josh, you have permission to talk.
Hi, Stuart. This is Joshua Saunders. And I'm wanted to ask about something. I think I remember a while back, I think that there was a lawsuit having to do with Social Security's kiosks. They are Social Security's been closed down due to the pandemic, but I never found out. And I think they're going to reopen again. But I wondered whether that lawsuit resolved in making their kiosks accessible. I never heard one way or another.
So my understanding is that there was a policy-based settlement to require accessible technology. I actually don't have it in front. I'd love to actually look it up, but that there were some difficulties with the shutdown. And so it's a great question, Josh. I don't actually know where it stands in terms of whether those changes have been implemented or not. And I'd be happy to look that up and respond to CCB. I know there was a break during the pandemic, and I don't know what's happened since then. So I think it's worth certainly worth us looking into, and we can update CCB about where it stands today.
Jordan, go ahead.
Yes, Josh, they are opened. I got an email from my Department of Rehabilitation counselors about a week or two ago, saying that Social Security has reopened.
So this is Stuart. I'm curious.
Cut out there.
I'm curious to know if the reopening includes the accessible technology. But I both Jordan and Josh, we will. I actually have not looked into that since the start of the pandemic, and I think that serves us to do so.
Oh, great. This has been a lot of good information, Stuart. Thank you so much for taking the time and of course, for everything you do in partnership with CCB on a lot of different issues, and really good information. And anything that you come up with, of course, we'll get back to our members. So thanks for joining us today and all the good work that you do for it.
Thanks, all of you. Great to speak with you.
Great. Okay. So we are going to break here in just a moment. but please do come back, because at 1 o'clock this afternoon, we'll be, that's 1 o'clock Pacific time. We'll be back with, our next session for this afternoon, and, also broadcast on ACB Media 8. We're going to hear more advocacy information from Andy Imperato, also, Joe Xavier from the Department of Rehabilitation, great transportation information from, our resident ACB transportation expert, Ron Brooks, and of course, our elections tonight and all weekend. Lots of good stuff happening at the convention. So thank you all for joining us this morning. We'll break now and look forward to having all you back come back this afternoon at 1 o'clock Pacific time.